The reading is from Mark's Gospel, chapter 5, verse 21, right through to verse 6 of chapter 6. When Jesus had again crossed over by the boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what she had done, what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talita kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to tell anyone, not to let anyone know about this, and told them to give her something to eat. Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. "Where did this man get these things?" they asked. "What's this wisdom that has been given him, that he even does miracles? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son, and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. Jesus said to them, "Only in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own house is a prophet without honor. He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them." And he was amazed at their lack of faith.
Thank you, Pearl. You know, the scriptures were written to be read and heard, and so it's such a blessing, isn't it, to have people that can read so beautifully for us. And it's easy to take that for granted, but it's fantastic. So thank you, Pearl. Jonathan Mosley is going to come and share. Jonathan's part of the leadership team of this church. But Jonathan is a humble person who serves so much in the background, and I really appreciate him, and I know so many of you do. So I just wanted to commend him to you as we start this morning. Let's just pray for Jonathan. Father, thank you for Jonathan. Thank you that his heart for you and his heart for this church, and in the busyness of his life, that he still chooses to serve us and to give time to bless and to lead us. Amen.
Well, thank you very much for that very kind endorsement, Simon. You might want to change that after I've finished speaking. This might be a bit of a challenging sermon, actually, but the topic is difficult, so I will say that in advance. So if you do find that uncomfortable, I would apologise for that. Disraeli famously said that two things in life are inevitable: death and taxes. Interestingly, even Jesus didn't escape from paying some tax. If you remember, there's an obscure incident in Matthew's gospel. But Jesus didn't choose, he could have, didn't avoid the tax, but he did choose to, didn't choose to avoid death either. To state the obvious, the immortal Son of God didn't avoid death, but that was for our sake. But that's a sermon for another day. If Disraeli's famous observation is a bit too gloomy for you, I've got another quote I quite like. I can't remember the source or where I got it from. I think it came from a Christian author. It was on a cartoon, I think. But I quite like this one. You might try this one. This particular wit said, "I believe God has put me on earth to achieve a certain number of things. Right now, I'm so far behind, I'm going to live forever." Personally, I'm going to hang on to that one. I'm sure many people can identify with that. Of course, it feels particularly tragic when death is premature, especially if it's a child. And before the sort of rather gloomy news about Brexit and coronavirus affected the news this week, we heard quite a lot about a basketball player who was killed in a helicopter crash in California, along with a number of other people, but including his daughter, who was about the same age as Jairus' daughter. He may have died prematurely, as I guess they all did, but he'd already achieved great fame and riches and wealth. His daughter, of course, still had most of her life to live, like Jairus' daughter, which I guess is that's what Jairus has in mind when he comes and throws himself at the feet of Jesus. So we're looking at the story of the healing of Jairus' daughter, but actually I'm going to expand my brief this morning, which is probably going to worry Simon quite a lot because the clock is already getting on. But I'm going to take it upon myself to include the passages we looked at last week, the storm on the lake, the healing of the demon-possessed man, through our passage today, and then on into the start of chapter 6. But it's all right, I won't talk for any longer, Simon. It'll still be an hour. Now, Simon did a great job last week, but I did think he missed an opportunity, because I think the Jews of their day, when Jesus crossed over into the other territory, they would quite happily have adopted Star Wars terminology in terms of referring to going over to the dark side to combat dark spiritual forces. So I think you missed an opportunity there, Simon. Okay, so we've got five stories here. We've got the storm on the lake. We've got, five stories, five miracles. The storm on the lake, the healing of the demon-possessed man, the woman with the constant bleeding, Jairus' daughter, and then some other miracles as well. So we've got five groups of people as well, and we're going to look at those. And I remind you that Simon also has told us that a recurring theme of Mark's gospel is fear and faith, and you'll see that in all of these passages. So let's look at each one of these groups in order. Firstly, the disciples, to go back to the end of chapter 4. And of course, they lived with Jesus, and they were literally in the boat with Jesus when the storm blew up. But they could only muster really a rather weak kind of faith. "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" they say to him, which just seems to be a pretty silly question, really. Of course Jesus cared, and they must have known that. So I guess what they're really saying is, "Save us." And I suppose they had a faith at that point. At least they seemed to have a faith that Jesus himself wasn't going to drown. And perhaps their question reveals that they believed that Jesus could save them if he wanted to. What they actually doubted was his care and his compassion for them and his commitment to them in that moment, not necessarily his power over nature and creation. I'm not sure that's not actually a worse thing to doubt, quite frankly. Anyway, Jesus certainly says it's a lack of faith, because he replies to them, why are you so afraid? There's that fear. Do you still have no faith? Not even some faith or a little faith, but no faith. And they were terrified and asked each other, who is this? Even the wind and waves obey him. So again, you've got that contrast between fear and faith. And then we move on to the demon-possessed man who saw Jesus at a distance, and he ran and he fell on his knees in front of Jesus. And you could see that as a kind of form of worship, although probably it's more a recognition that Jesus is like a king or a general who has power of life and death over him. And he shouted at the top of his voice, what do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me. Now, faith is not mentioned here, but it's clear that these demons had a type of faith, if you like, a fearful faith. It's more than just knowledge. In fact, they appear to have more faith than the disciples in recognizing that Jesus has real power in this situation. They're in terror of being tortured, which, obviously, if they'd understood anything about Jesus' nature, they would have realized was nonsense, but they couldn't do that. And I'd just like to pause for a moment to note this apparent incongruity here in suggesting that they had some kind of faith or belief, because it's not a saving faith. They weren't putting their trust in Jesus, they were just recognizing that he had power. And some people will say that they believe in Jesus, but they don't acknowledge that in any kind of meaningful way. Perhaps they need to be saved from their sins. People will say, I believe in Jesus, but they don't believe that they need to join with other believers, we might call them Christians, or go through the tiresome business of meeting regularly, we might call that a church, or in fact actually giving up control of their lives, we might call that worship or service or sacrifice. So it's possible to believe in Jesus and not be saved, as these demons clearly weren't. And James sums this up really quite succinctly in his letter to his readers when he says in chapter 2, verse 19, you believe there is one God. Great! Even the demons believe that and shudder, fear. Okay? And James perhaps had this particular instance in mind when he wrote that to his readers. And for context, James has said that directly after he's just said, show me your faith without deeds and I will show you my faith by my deeds. In other words, faith or belief by itself isn't enough. It has to lead to action, and it has to lead to positive action. Firstly, a saving faith, and then, of course, a care for the church, for the community, for creation itself. Let's move on to someone who did have a positive faith and actually expresses that, the woman who had the constant bleeding. Now, she had a rather simple, or I might call almost a superstitious faith in a way. And with apologies to all the medics present, I think I get a very raw deal from this. We're told that she'd wasted all of her money, let's say, on private doctors. So we really should thank God for the NHS. But she has this rather superstitious faith, a bit like magic, and that's not untypical of many people down the ages, even now perhaps, and not just in less developed parts of the world. But she's got a faith. And notice, this faith is strong enough to take action. This timid woman manages to push away through this bustling crowd to get near to Jesus. So she takes action to get near to Jesus and literally to reach out and try and grab hold of him. And actually her faith is strong enough to achieve the miracle all by itself. And if you think that's a bit odd, how could someone drain or access the Holy Spirit's power from Jesus without his permission? I'd like to draw your attention to a verse from John's Gospel, chapter 14, verse 12, the meaning of which I understand has been much debated. For context, this is during the Last Supper, and Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, I tell you the truth, anyone who has faith in me will do what I have been doing. He's just mentioned miracles, by the way. And they will do even greater things than these, because I'm going to the Father. So Jesus anticipates a time shortly when he will not be present on earth, and he clearly expects those who have faith in him to do greater things, greater works, greater miracles by direct access to God's Spirit, not by his own presence. And of course, that has to be the case anyway, because if there's going to be any Christian activity and blessing in the world, it can't just be localized around Jesus in space and time. So by sending his Spirit and leaving his Spirit with us, all people in all places and in all periods have been able to access Jesus' saving power and healing power. And then finally, we come to Jairus, whose daughter is dying, and his faith has also compelled him to come to Jesus. to plead for him to cure his daughter. Please come and put your hands on her so that she'll be healed and live. So he's expressing a kind of real believing faith in this case. But notice, he's going to get tested as well. And if we contrast Jairus with the woman just before who actually delays Jesus from going to actually save his daughter, Jairus comes openly, the woman sort of comes in secret. And I suspect in her case, that's because of her low status. She's a woman, of course, in a patriarchal society, almost certainly lacking status and self-confidence in herself, and quite possibly treated as unclean due to this complete continuous bleeding that she suffered from. She wouldn't have felt able to approach Jesus, and perhaps as a teacher, a rabbi, she wouldn't actually have been allowed to speak to him without him initiating the conversation. He's effectively a local celebrity anyway by this stage, and she probably think he wouldn't actually touch him, again, because of the bleeding and the uncleanness that might go with that. Although I think we can assume that he definitely would have done. So she has to come secretly. But Jairus comes publicly. And let's just think about the context of that for a moment, because he's one of the synagogue leaders. He's effectively a local dignitary. He's probably a rich man and educated with a business relative to his neighbours. Maybe not a great person, but compared to his neighbours with some education. He's got position and status in that community where he's well known. He's, if you like, he's in the established church of his day, the synagogue. It might be a bit like an Anglican minister or bishop, perhaps, falling on their knees before a self-taught, itinerant, Pentecostal miracle worker or preacher, which is essentially what Jesus was, and begging him for his help. You've got to think about that kind of level of difference in status in terms of how Jairus approaches this. If it's helpful, you could make a comparison between Simon's father-in-law, who happens to be the Bishop of Oxford, and Simon, who happens to be our minister in his check shirt for our non-conformist church here this morning. But Jairus' daughter is dying, and so none of his status, or his wealth, or his education, or his position, even the tradition of his religion, is going to help him in this situation. He needs a miracle, and actually I was pleased that Roger sort of mentioned that in his prayers. You know, he needs a miracle in this situation. And so in his fine robes and his fine clothes, in the public square, in front of a crowd of witnesses, he falls on the dirt in front of Jesus at his knees and begs him to come and save his daughter. And that's rather similar to the two previous cases, except, of course, he's now expressing worship and prayer and a positive belief that Jesus can heal his daughter. And just think about this also, because he's done this very openly. And if Jesus doesn't save his daughter, he's going to lose more than just his daughter, okay? He's going to lose face heavily. He's going to lose his standing in the community. He's going to be mocked and pitied for trusting in this man, or appearing to. He's going to be sad, shunned, and quite possibly end up bitter. So he's really put himself on the line here in terms of his faith. So Jesus does need to deliver for him. And Jesus, of course, agrees to go with him and then curse it. This woman with the consistent bleeding then turns up, and Jesus has to deal with her. And she, of course, also falls at Jesus' feet when she has to come forward in fear, but, of course, Jesus deals with her gently. And during this time, the messengers come and tell Jairus that his daughter has died, but Jesus encourages him, don't be afraid, just believe. Don't be afraid, just believe. So, again, you've got more fear and faith. But there's another test of faith going on here, I think, and Mark doesn't make very much of this for Jairus, but now the facts have changed. Okay, his daughter was dying, now she's dead. He no longer needs a miracle for healing, he needs a miracle for someone to raise the dead. Is his faith up to it? And I think this is a temptation for someone like Jairus, probably not for us, because there's probably an expectation within that community and for religious practice of the day. The professional mourners were probably already in the house. Everyone would want to sympathize with Jairus on his loss. They would make a fuss of him because of his status and his position. And that might have been easy for him to have given up on that and just dropped into that role that society or the community expected of him. But thankfully, he doesn't do that. And his faith is rewarded, and his daughter becomes one of just three people in the Gospels that Jesus raises from the dead. Clearly, Jairus has a strong faith. We're not told where that comes from, But the point is, he does risk everything he currently has, and he puts his trust in Jesus. And then his faith is immediately put to a stronger test. We are not guaranteed that everything will be well in this life if we trust in Jesus, or put our trust in Jesus. They always say, don't they, about stocks and shares, that investments can go down as well as up. Okay, and then our final group this morning actually are, well, disappointingly, the family, the friends, and the neighbours of Jesus, who appear to have no faith, or very little faith, because they knew him, or they thought they did. There's no faith expressed here, and there's apparently no fear, although they took offence at him, and I think that response is really a different side of the same coin of expressing fear. And I was going to reread verses 5 and 6 with emphasis, because I think, I don't know whether you've noticed this before, but I think verse 5 is one of the most astonishing verses in the whole of the New Testament. And in rather British fashion, it's also possibly one of the greatest understatements as well. Let's have a look at that again. Okay. So it says, Jesus could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few people who were ill and heal them. And he was amazed at their lack of faith. Just think about that. He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few people and heal them. But that doesn't sort of count. Who'd been ill. And he was amazed at the lack of faith. So there's two things there. Firstly, that he only did a few miracles, but that doesn't really count for anything. And secondly, that they actually their lack of faith was enough to actually stop Jesus from working. If someone turned up this morning, anyone, or Jesus, obviously, and laid hands on a few sick people in Alma and healed them, you know, or even in Woodlands, where such things might happen, any church, quite frankly, we'd all be flabbergasted. Hopefully our response would be joyful praise. We'd be ecstatic. And actually, if our response wasn't that, then we need to take a good, strong look at ourselves. I think that's quite amazing, really. And no wonder Jesus was amazed at their lack of faith. But notice that Jesus, in the same way that Jesus didn't stop the woman from being healed who had the continuous bleed, he also doesn't force himself upon people. And actually, their lack of faith was enough to sort of quench that spirit. Jesus won't force himself upon anybody for either saving or for an expression of faith. So, okay, I'm going to round up now, and I'm sure you can see where I'm going with this. But I think there are real dangers for those of us who have been Christians for a long time. Perhaps we've got too comfortable in our association or our relationship with Jesus, or too settled in our circumstances. Because who are the people who had the least faith in all of these passages? It's those who knew Jesus best, his family, his friends, and his neighbours. The disciples, the people he'd chosen and who committed themselves to him, they weren't a lot better, even though they lived with him for 3 years. They shared his life. They received teaching from him. They saw all the other miracles, for heaven's sake. We need to think about which category we might be in now, or which one we want to be in, because we do have a choice in how we respond to this and also how we exercise our faith. Other passages in the Bible talk about exercising faith. The storms of life, both literal and metaphorical, are going to come and batter and test us, as they did for the disciples, as they did for Jairus, whether we like it or not. And like the demon-possessed man, many people these days, not demon possession, but many people feel trapped in destructive behaviours, either from themselves or which are imposed on them externally, which they feel they can't escape from. We're all living longer, which means we're probably all going to have to put up with more chronic illness, like the woman in the passage. And just to be really cheerful, whilst you can't cheat the tax man, and I do need to say, because this is being recorded, obviously I can't advocate that you try and do that. You can't cheat the tax man, but we also we can't cheat death either. So let's not be like those people who knew Jesus well, who had little faith in him, and actually were able to quench the power of God's Spirit. What a tragedy that is. Let's not be like the demon-possessed man, who only thought God wanted to punish and torture him, which again, many people think have that image of God. And let's try and do better than the disciples, who thought Jesus didn't care for them in their moment or their hour of need, that Jesus is only there for them in the good times. If we can only manage the faith, the simple faith, maybe the slightly superstitious faith of the woman with the constant bleeding, that's a good place to be. Let's go with that. But there's a general principle that more is expected from those to whom more has been given. And I would politely suggest that in Alma, in Bristol, in the West, in 2020, we've been given an abundance of riches in every sense. So let's aspire to be more like Jairus if we can, but let's also recognise as well that it's not going to be trouble-free. If faith in Jesus is going to mean anything, it has to mean something in the difficult times as well, I'm afraid. Okay, I haven't pulled my punches this morning, and I feel I need to step out in faith a bit as well, perhaps like the disciples and Jairus. So to justify what I said, so I'm going to confess, I haven't got the faith to pray for raising the dead or for exorcism. Feel free to ask if you want someone to pray for those things, but I will be finding some professional help, and I'm going to warn you that's probably going to be Simon. But I will pray for anything else that anybody else wants to pray for that may have come up from this passage or some of the other things, perhaps particularly for healing as well. I've prayed for healing for a number of people recently, in recent years, many of whom have been healed and some of whom haven't, including my mother who died last year, as you know. God isn't going to answer all of our prayers in the way that we would like. Actually, I prefer to make a commitment to pray for you, not just after the service, but actually long term. So if you'd like to take me up on that, please do ask me afterwards. But I'm sure others will also pray for some of these things after the service as well, and we can find some people to pray for you on that. Simon.
Thank you. As Jonathan was sharing there, I was just a scripture that came to my mind was that great prayer, I guess it is, where the man says to Jesus, "Lord, help my unbelief." What a great little statement. Help my unbelief. And as Jonathan was sharing, I was thinking, actually, it doesn't matter where we are right now. That is a great prayer to pray. If you feel like you have a lack of faith or all the faith you need, then a great prayer is, "Lord, help my unbelief. Help me to have the faith I need." And I've asked John just to lead us straight into this sort of closing song, which is, again, it's a prayer. It's, "Lord, would you be my vision? Would you be the one I look to, the one I believe in?" So if you can, stand with us, and we're going to sing this as our closing song.